You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is one of the fastest growing social media applications that there is, dedicated to outdoor enthusiasts. This app is basically a community of all like-minded individuals who love Mother Nature, love to be outside, love hunting, fishing, camping, all the activities that people love to do outside. You're going to find a community for those activities within Go Wild. Now, you can download the app directly to your mobile device, your phone, and you can find that at the Google Play Store. That's where I download all my apps. Or for more information, you can go to timetogowild.com. Read up on the app, read what it's all about, lots of detail on their website. So get outside. It's time to go wild.
All right, guys, welcome to a Habitat Heroes podcast. I'm Adam.
And I am Matt.
And we're very, very excited to let you guys hear this podcast. This is an interview I did with Kyle Hedges from the Missouri Department of Conservation, who's a biologist there. He's been there a long time, and he's really focused a lot of his latest research on grasslands, some of our native prairies management, and focusing on the populations of the northern bobwhite quail. Some fascinating research that everyone can learn from: deer hunters, deer managers, cattle farmers, quail hunters, turkey hunters, whatever.
Land
lovers. People that are interested in trapping or are on the fence about trapping.
Yep.
And they, maybe you're one that really think that trapping is crucial to your production of your property, basically nest predators. Maybe that's a term you like a lot, or you're really worried about the amount of predators on your place. There's going to be information in this podcast about that. So a lot of information gets shared here by Kyle. It's one of my favorite podcasts as far as new information that we haven't really jumped into a lot. And so hopefully you guys enjoy it.
But as they will be able to tell, though, there's much more that can be learned, you know, beyond just this podcast. There's so much more information out there regarding the studies and stuff that Kyle and his team are doing. And I think the most important thing to realize is Kyle's not only a state employee of Missouri, he's a scientist, biologist, and a hunter himself. So he covers the entire basis and most likely brings that perspective to all this research that they're doing. And I think that's important. You know, it's not just from a biologist standpoint, it's not just from a hunter standpoint. Well-rounded, accurate, up-to-date information on quail and upland bird management and cattle management.
Yep. To me, this was just, well, you'll hear one of my questions, and I'll go ahead and share it because it's so good, and hopefully it hooks you guys into listening to his whole presentation. But so I ask him through this the question of really kind of, we're looking at the importance of grazing and the importance of fire. And I ask him the question point blank, like, if you had to pick one, which one would it be? You'll have to listen to find out which one he picks. But it was surprising to me, and he explains why he chooses that. Now, both are hugely important, but I think we overlook one of them when it comes to managing our landscape. And because it is such a kind of a negative with mismanagement of this practice.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even Aldo Leopold talks about it being important to the landscape. So, yeah, hopefully you guys like it. I have a feeling you will. Anybody that's looking to improve the population of quail on their farm, you're going to enjoy it.
If you have any follow-up questions or questions regarding anything we talk about, info@landlegacy.tv. We'd love to hear from you.
All right, guys. Welcome to another Land and Legacy Habitat Heroes podcast. I'm your host, Adam Keith. This is a podcast I've been looking forward to for some time now. We have a guest coming on that's got a background in something we haven't designated an entire podcast to yet, for reasons unknown, other than the fact that we realized if we had covered this topic right in the middle of whitetail rut, we might have been ran out of town. So we're going to cover a lot of upland management, and we have a guy who's got a long resume in quail and all things. And I think another species, too, we'll cover on also. But we've got Kyle Hedges from the Missouri Department of Conservation. Kyle, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, so we didn't even talk about this pre-show, but weren't you involved in some of the prairie chicken restoration or trapping?
A little bit, yeah. We'll talk more here about some quail research we've done, but my partner in the quail research project was on the prairie chicken recovery team.
Gotcha.
Frank Longcarriage. I was not on that team, but did go to Kansas and help trap prairie chickens and bring them back to Missouri. And my time in Kansas, I worked in Kansas for 5 years and in an area that had quite a few prairie chickens. We did prairie chicken habitat management there as well.
That's awesome. So kind of tell me a little bit about what is your position and kind of, I guess, your long resume of how you got to this position.
Yeah, so my official title, I'm here in Bolivar, Missouri. I take care of public land in Cedar, Dade, and Polk counties. My official title is wildlife management biologist. Oversee 22,000 acres of public land. And I've got a wildlife biologist works under me, and then a couple salaried resource technicians, that do a lot of the field work and help burn and spray invasives, just a variety of work. I started out my career in Kansas, went to K-State, got a degree in fish and wildlife, and worked at Fort Riley Military Reservation, the northern part of the Flint Hills, for 5 years. And that we had quail management, pheasants, prairie chickens, a little bit of everything there. And then I moved to northwest Missouri and managed some stuff along the Missouri River. Was real good for quail and pheasants, managed it a lot. It was bottom ground, but still managed some wetland stuff, but managed a lot of it for quail and pheasants and was quite successful, actually. The floods, after I moved away from that job in 2003, the floods have ravaged it several times. But prior to that, it was quite successful.
Wow.
For upland hunting, even though it was bottom land. Now, I've been in this job down here since 03, so 15, going on 16 years. And we focus mainly on these 22,000 acres. The majority of it is quail management, which, of course, turns out it's good for turkeys and rabbits and deer and lots of other species. So it's pretty easy to target quail, knowing you're doing good stuff for a lot of other species as well.
For sure. What would you say comparison of quail management versus deer management?
Specific deer management, a lot of people are focusing more on high energy food sources, probably a lot of food plot type stuff. And that's been done quite a bit in the past for quail management, but we're finding out, and we'll talk more about it, I think, coming up, but that maybe that's not the best approach. The quail were quite abundant before we had food plots strung all over the countryside around here.
Yeah.
With quail, we're not worried about growing big antlers. We're not worried about, we just got to keep them alive, and they've got to, be healthy enough to lay eggs and raise some chicks. So it's kind of a different nutrition need. So, and then we don't worry about, obviously with quail, we want as much open space as possible, where lots of times people that are focusing on the deer management, they want some dense woods, and that's just, for a quail, that's just wasted space. But
yeah,
what we find out on a lot of our areas, a lot of the areas, open areas that I do manage, we've got some pretty big deer. Kansas is proof, right?
A lot of Kansas,
big wide open prairie country or big CRP fields, and there's some pretty big deer that bed down in there. So it turns out, this may, some of your audience may disagree with me, but you don't necessarily have to have a 20-acre cedar thicket to grow big deer. we can grow big deer in some pretty open spaces.
I think if anybody's hung along, this is our 100th podcast for the Habitat Hero, so that kind of a big milestone. But if anybody's hung on for 100 podcasts, by now they know that that we love the Kansas Flint Hills because of its kind of natural ecosystem that's a little bit more unmolested, if you will, compared to some of the other places in the country. And we love the Southwest, like Southwest of Missouri, so Oklahoma. We love most of the rolling prairie down there too. So I'd say people by now, we kind of already have labeled cedar tree haters and fescue old field haters. So I think people know now that we have preached so much about big deer can be grown in grasses and weeds and use the examples of Kansas and Oklahoma. So
yeah, that's awesome.
So one of the big things about this week that I really want to cover, and we have to get into it quick because I have no idea how many questions it's going to stir up. But Kyle, can you give us a little bit of the I keep calling it the 7-year study, but you've kind of got a couple years in there that was more of a pilot program. Give me a kind of a 30,000 view of the project that you guys have going on.
Yeah, so we conducted the biggest quail research project that's ever happened in Missouri, involving radio collars. So this started out, we had a couple pilot years to kind of test our theory. Again, Frank Longkarich, another wildlife management biologist, he manages land down in further southwest, Lawrence, Newton, McDonald counties. Myself and him got together, and we were noticing a trend where we have MDC, Missouri Department of Conservation, has areas that we call quail emphasis areas, and most of these are managed heavily with food plots. We call them the traditional management type, right? This was done years ago to mimic the old dairy farm. So we'll have a grass strip, a crop strip, a plum strip, and then a grass strip. I mean, just really dissected landscape. And it grows some quail. But that was our model of this is how we should do quail management on public land in Missouri. And we've been doing that. The department been doing that for 30, 40 years that way. And we weren't saying it doesn't work, it grows some quail, but we were noticing that despite all of our efforts, we were working really hard on these areas that were quail emphasis areas. We had some open grasslands, native prairies to be specific, but just open grasslands that we were managing a little differently with just fire and grazing in other parts of my district. And our quail numbers were superior on these open grasslands compared to these intensively managed quail areas. So we came together and said, man, we've got to research this and figure out why, what's going on. We're spending all our time and money on these intensive quail emphasis areas, and we're growing about half as many quail as we are out here on these grasslands where we're not even really trying to grow quail. They're just a byproduct of our management. So we did a little bit of work for a couple years, kind of proved maybe we were on to something, and luckily with the help of some other folks within the department, got some funding approved and embarked on a 5-year full-blown research project. It involved, started out with 4 areas. By the end of it, there was 6 public areas being researched. In the course of that time, we radio collared over 1,500 quail. We monitored over 400 quail nests. So this is a giant data set. Nothing like this, again, has been done in the state of Missouri. And we found out some interesting information. In a nutshell, sure enough, we were right. The grasslands are outproducing the intensively managed areas. So we think we have a path forward of maybe it's time to shift gears and start focusing on a little bit more open management. There are several reasons why, and we'll go into that discussion here as we progress. But certainly we've proven what we thought we were seeing anecdotally, that nesting is superior, adult survival is superior, Brood survival is superior. All these things are superior on these big open grasslands as compared to these food plot managed areas.
Wow. And that is something, when you look at the management that goes into, I just think of, you had your dairy farm type management where you had the strips. Like, when you look at that from a management side and a time side, that's just, it takes a lot of time, and really it's not something that every farmer could use, because you've broken up the landscape so much, and how many cattle farmers are going to want to see a shrub lane?
Right.
Or it's just not possible. Right. So what you basically did was found that something that is already being practiced, grazing, and look at grasslands, and now you're seeing a huge increase in quail numbers.
Correct. And you know, part of, in defense of MDC, part of the reason back in the 70s when they bought a lot of this land and dissected it that way is, you know, at the time you went with what you knew and what was working. You go with the most recent science, the most recent evidence. I mean, that's how we manage stuff. But we got to be willing to open our minds to, hey, things have changed.
Yeah.
The dairy farm high quail numbers thing, it did exist. I mean, that's not a myth. It did happen.
Yeah.
Our belief is, though, as those, when half the county looked like that, it was highly successful. The problem is, over time, these MDC areas that were dissected and broke up and stripped out, all the neighboring land around those areas was no longer being managed that way. And so after a 20, 30-year progression, those areas turned into mostly fescue landscape, overgrazed fescue in a lot of cases. So all of a sudden, when the public land in the middle is an island of that old dairy farm kind of habitat, rather than one of hundreds of thousands of acres of that same habitat, it doesn't function as well. When it becomes an island, it does not function the same as it did when half the county looked like that. So I think it did work better back in the 70s when MDC first set that up, but the landscape has changed so much that the effect is no longer being felt of that management type. And I think we've uncovered, if we're going to manage quail on these islands, the public lands are certainly islands in a lot of cases, but there's some private land applicability. If we can spread this out, get some of the neighbors on some of this public land doing some similar management with this open grasslands and fire and grazing, we can expand that influence. But certainly as it stands now, if we're restricted to islands of habitat, the grasslands are far superior to the food plot stripped out areas.
That's amazing. Is this something, I know there's an initiative kind of in NRCS is talking about it a lot, but trying to get more cattle farmers involving native grasses into their rotation for summer grazing, but also the huge benefit is quail habitat. Is this kind of a direction that you guys helped push that with your research, or is that just something that cattle farmers are thinking and doing just because of the gains?
All of the above, I think. This research came out maybe in a very timely era here, where at the same time, Missouri suffered several droughts. We had a drought, bad drought, 05-06, had another drought maybe around 2012, and then everybody knows this summer was a hard drought. So the USDA offices, the NRCS, they've been trying to push folks, hey, here's a alternative to fescue in the summer. Instead of feeding bales and your cattle aren't gaining any weight, and you're having to use up some of your bale supply that you should be saving for wintertime, if you have these native grasses, we have research on it. You know, you can see yields of over 2 pounds a day gain on your cattle in July when it's 104 degrees outside. So there's been some push to plant some natives, to integrate natives into a cow-calf operation. For sure, if you were running a stalker, if you were a backgrounder, growing stocker cattle, you for sure need some natives in your operation to get through that summer slump.
Yeah.
But it's been timely because at the same time, our research was coming out showing that these native grass, these open grasslands are superior for not just cattle yields in the summer, but also for quail management. And at the same time, Quail Forever, the Missouri Quail Forever, they hired a grassland grazing biologist a couple years ago. So they were starting to see the benefit of, hey, we need to be targeting, instead of just always targeting row crop landowners and trying to work with little corners and little pieces of property and buffer strips for quail, there's an opportunity to work with these ranchers that have a lot of cattle. And then also the national Bob White Conservation Initiative, the MBCI, they hired a grassland grazing coordinator who happens to live in Missouri. So there's been a recognition all in the last 5 or 6 years that, hey, maybe we need to start looking at these grasslands a little harder for some quail restoration. And our research just fell right into place with that. So I don't know who pushed who, which came first, the chicken or the egg, but it certainly has all kind of came together from several different angles at a good time.
Yeah, at that rate, who cares how it got here? We're just happy it did. Yeah. Huh. So when you're talking grazing on the native grasslands, that kind of your research site, walk me through the steps or the management style of that grazing.
Yeah, so, you know, grazing isn't grazing. Lots of people, when you think about wildlife and grazing has a bad name because people have driven across Missouri and there's thousands and hundreds of thousands of acres of overgrazed fescue. That's the misuse of grazing. Grazing isn't bad. It's the application of it that can be good or bad. Too little of grazing or no grazing on warm season grass can be negative as well. So I'll give you an example, a CRP field that currently, you know, grazing is not allowed on CRP. So lots of times CRP fields get too thick, too rank, and there's not much quail use in them. We get a lot of rainfall in Missouri. We get this part of the state, we get over 45 inches of rain. And our grass, even our native grasses, they get too thick that the birds can't move around at ground level. So it needs some frequent disturbance, fire, grazing, strip disking, whatever. Well, you can't burn it all or you have nowhere to nest. So our grazing on our conservation areas, we call conservation grazing, or it would be considered a moderate grazing. So we will stock, we'll burn a third of the acres. You don't even have to burn anything for this to work. The quail will still use it. And our radio telemetry, the glory of putting radio collars on anything is they don't lie. We track birds around, and the birds go where they want to be. And we can document parts of the area that they completely avoid and all the parts that they use more than you would expect them to. So it really tells us what kind of habitat those birds want. But these grasslands that we're grazing, we're putting typically 1,000 pounds of cattle per 5 acres. I've gone down as low as 2.5 to 3 acres for short duration. I've gone as high as 7 acres per 1,000 pounds. So there's no hard and fast rule, but some moderate stocking rate, 1,000 pounds around per 5 acres. And we're doing that for about 120 days. Now I've grazed as short as 60. I've grazed as long as 150. So again, no hard and fast rules, but we're by stocking, that moderate stocking rate and throughout the summer season, so that's typically May 1st to August 31st. These are warm season grasses. They don't even start growing until the ground temp gets above 50. So stocking this midsummer, that's right during the nesting and brood rearing season. Well, what will happen is we're not looking for 100% utilization like most fescue cattle operations do. We only want maybe 50% if you were to add it all up. We get this mosaic of habitat, and really, truthfully, to really get a mosaic, we will burn a third of the unit but stock cattle in the whole unit. So if we were grazing a 300-acre unit, we might burn two 50-acre units. So 100 acres total gets burned in the spring. Well, the cattle will spend two-thirds of their time grazing, just like bison used to, in that one-third that was burned. So it gets grazed a little shorter than the rest of the area. And then they fill their rumen by picking around in the other two-thirds of the area. So that provides some nesting areas that are a little thicker, but then we have some heavier grazed areas that next year grow back heavy in weeds or forbs. And then we'll rotate those burn units around the landscape. So each year we have a mosaic of habitat heights, grass heights and weed heights, but also species diversity changes within each unit, because depending whether it was burned and grazed a little harder the year before, as that rotates across the landscape. Those weedy units are that are full of forbs, whatever you want to call them. Weeds have a bad name, but they're actually great for quail. That's what attracts the bugs, the grasshoppers and all the small bugs, and that's what these quail need to eat all summer. And in particular, the broods, the chicks, need to eat bugs. So we'll find that they spend a lot of time in those units that were grazed a little heavier, that were burned that the year before and grazed a little heavier. The next year, they move, focus their grazing on the new burn units, and they kind of back off the last year's burn units. So it really creates this, the best mosaic. We can't create that with any other equipment. We can't do it with a disc, a mower. You can't replicate that. The cattle is the cheapest, easiest way to do that.
Yeah, and also the cattle bring in, while they're there, there's lots of manure and other insects that come in because of the cattle, so I'm sure that's helping the quail as well.
Absolutely, and the manure, you know, a good example, another common management practice, or the other common management practice on native prairie or even just warm season grasses, is haying. Well, haying removes all the nutrients from the site. Haying makes everything uniform, goes from uniform tall to uniform short, and it all grows back at the same time. Whereas grazing, those nutrients are deposited in manure right back on the landscape. So we don't deplete the phosphorus, the potash, the nitrogen. We're not depleting the soil of the nutrients like haying does. So That's another benefit. Soil health is much improved with grazing versus haying.
So with radio-collared quail, and you burn, what's the movement pattern of the quail in relation to the burning?
So, they get up and fly out of the unit. So adult quail will just fly out of it.
Yep.
We're spring burning, it's a non-issue. We've never burned up a radio-collared quail with a spring burn. They escape. They know how to get out of it.
I guess my reason for that question is after the burn, initially, like, do you see more activity near the burned areas, or do you see more activity in the areas that weren't burned? And I'm going to ask question in relation to cows, too.
Yeah, so they're certainly displaced for a bit.
Yeah.
Right. If they're living in a unit that gets burned, they're displaced until you get some regrowth. But we found it doesn't take long. So if we're doing a spring burn, you know, we start getting regrowth and we will get. We'll sometimes have birds stay within a burn unit within a woody draw or something.
Yeah.
Lots of times they'll still utilize the woody draw, even though the grass next to the draw is burned. But obviously the open grass part is unavailable for use, but it's short-lived. As soon as we start getting some growth, and we only have to get up about 8 to 10 inches, and the quail will recolonize that. They feel comfortable and concealed enough. And that's where lots of the new growth is. They'll pick some green vegetation as well, but that's where a lot of the bugs are first going to show up, on that new vegetation. So they immediately move into that as soon as it starts attracting bugs.
Yeah. What about with relation to the cattle?
The cattle we typically burn before the cattle are stocked, but if and when, and other research shows it, and we've done it a couple times, if we burn while the cattle are already stocked, they will be back in the burn unit pretty much before the ash settles. They immediately move back in it, and they are looking now. This is, if the cattle were already in there, that means you're already in the growing season.
Yep.
But I mean, the moment the regrowth starts, they are eating it. They know, their brain tells them this is the most nutritious stuff out here, and that's what they want. They don't want that year-old brown stuff and the other units. They want that new green growth.
And that's similar to that would be kind of that concept as the patch burn grazing type management style, correct?
That's exactly what it is. It's called patch burn grazing, where we burn a patch or multiple patches. We burn a third of it, and we rotate that around each year, but we stock the whole pasture. Yep, we utilize patch burn grazing. And we, again, straight grazing without burning for quail, we'll still get use. We just won't get the more chaotic pattern of use by the cattle, which creates more habitat diversity, heights, and structure. We're looking for that kind of chaos in our grassland heights and diversity, because that way the quail can choose what, you know, they're going to use a different unit for nesting or different, not a unit, but different structure for nesting as they may for raising their brood. So the maximum we can create diversity in heights and structure, we can give them all these different options of where they want to do their business throughout the year.
I just got to warn or let the audience know that I didn't pay you. I don't have you under contract. You're using some of our keywords on our weekly podcast with chaos, diversity, and mosaic. Those might be the three top ones, and you're just nailing it. You're doing a great job. Oh, so the reason I asked that, I think I remember reading research one time that was radio collared quail following patch burn grazing, and they noticed that the quail were just like always a few days behind the rotation of the cows, and it was like that the disturbance that the cows created was exactly what the quail needed, and so they were following directly behind because of the amount of insects and disturbance that created higher success rates of the quail.
Yes. Now, we don't see it within the grazing unit specifically going to this burn patch to burn patch. We do see a higher brood use the following year in, you know, because that one unit, like I say, it was burned, it gets grazed a little heavier, and it's the weedier unit. But
yeah.
But the entire grazing unit, again, back to my 300-acre example, the nice thing about it, I'll give you some statistics here that will play out. In my 300-acre example, if we burn 100 acres of that, but the cattle graze 300 acres, we get all 300 acres will be utilized by adult quail as well as chicks, as well as broods. Where we use fire alone, and we have, again, radio colors don't lie, where we use fire alone, so we would burn a third and then not graze it, just idle it, right? So two-thirds is idled, one-third was burned. We get brood use in that one-third that's burned. The rest of it's too thick. They can't raise their chicks in that stuff that's too thick because we get too much rainfall. So we have information proving that we get less than 5% brood use in something that was idle. Idle, air quotes, idle, in our research, is anything that wasn't grazed or burned or somehow disturbed, strip disc if it wasn't a native prairie, in the last 12 months. So if it wasn't burned or grazed in the last 12 months on these grasslands, they will not raise chicks in it. Well, that's wasted space if I'm trying to maximize quail on 300 acres and I'm only burning a third of it and I'm not grazing any of it. That means I'm only using 100 acres that's available for brood rearing. Now, how can I maximize quail production if I'm only utilizing a third of my acres? It's impossible. Mm. But with the cow, I put cattle out there, and I get brood use on all 300 acres. So I just tripled my production availability acreage.
Mm. So if I was to ask you, if you're managing a property for straight quail, would you go which one would you say is more important? And you can say that neither is more important, that they're both important. But is grazing more important than the fire, or fire more important than the grazing?
I would argue that both of them are necessary. The quail has been, in the southeast, has been referred to as a fire bird, and there's a reason. You know, it's evolved with fire. But if I absolutely, you tied my hands by my back and said, you got to pick one, At this point in the game, I would pick grazing.
Wow.
I may have to fight woody succession. I may have to fight trees. I may have to do some other work chemically. Or mechanically, you know, I may have to fight some of those other obstacles that fire beats back for me. But, yeah, because if I take that 300 acres and say I'm only going to have fire, well, I can't burn all 300 acres.
Yeah.
First of all, in my world, I manage 22,000 acres. I don't have time to burn it all anyway.
Yeah.
There's not enough burn days. But even if I was just managing 300 acres or 1,000 acres or whatever, I can't burn it all because where are the birds going to nest? I got to have some nesting cover, right?
Yep.
So the best I could do would be burn half of it. Well, then I would have half of it available for nesting, half of it available for brood rearing. I'm still not maximizing quail.
Yeah.
With cattle, I can use the entire area. And we find with our stocking rate, any of you that are thinking, well, the cattle are just going to trample the nests. Nope. You've got to get down into stocking rates, and there's plenty of documentation out there and research into one animal per acre to get into trampling rates. They just know not to step on that clump of grass that the nest is tucked under.
Hmm.
So we did lose. I'm not going to say we never lost a nest to cattle. We did lose a couple nests over this research, but they were bedding areas where a cow laid down and rolled over and smashed a nest, but
yeah.
It was minuscule in the grand scheme of things. I mean, we monitored over 500 nests, and we only had a few that something like that occurred. So
yeah.
The nest success was so much higher regarding predation and everything else on the grasslands.
Yeah,
And we can talk about that here in a minute.
That's exactly what you opened up the door to lead right into that conversation of about predation on and loss of nests and overall just loss of quail. So in this research, I know you and I have talked in the past, but there's some interesting findings that you guys had. But talk about a little bit about the predation of the quail.
Okay, yeah. And first, let me give you a little bit of nesting success stats. I keep saying the grasslands were better, but let me give you some real data. So our traditional sites, and this is the five-year study combined, our traditional sites ranged in nesting success. Well, let me back up. People consider the average nesting success for ground nesting birds, turkeys, quail, to be around 35%. A third of the nests hatch, most of them, two-thirds get lost to predation or weather or whatever. So our traditional sites, the food plot managed areas, over the course of five-year study, ranged in nest success from 18% up to a high was 33%. That's a five-year average. That's three different sites. The worst was 18%, the highest was 33%. So they weren't even meeting what is considered the average, and that's for 5 years combined. Our grassland sites averaged, one of them was 43% nest success for 5 years combined average, and another was 44%. So pretty obvious, low 30s. On traditional areas to low to mid 40% nest success. Obviously, right from the start, we're hatching more quail in the grasslands.
Mm.
Now, what's getting those nests? The number one is common nest predator is snakes. So there's not much we can do about that directly. But that goes back towards the grazing, why maybe the grazing areas are more successful. If you don't have grazing, I already talked about our high rainfall, you have heavier thatch. So if you have heavier thatch, you have more rodents. Now, this is a theory. I can't back this up because we didn't research this aspect. But I'm pretty sure this makes common sense, and I'm going to stand behind it. The more thatch I have, the more rodents I have. The more rodents I have, the more snake density I'm going to have. Whereas our grazed areas have less thatch, less rodents, thus less snakes crawling around. So we see that on the reptile, and that's probably over 50% of our nests that fail are due to snakes. The rest, you know, we have a few that get abandoned. You have just bad mothers. They just get up and leave. First-time mom, and they don't really know what they're doing. Of course, with quail, most of them are first-time moms because they don't live much past a year old. But other predators are then, of course, small mammals. We lose them to raccoons, possums, skunks, stuff like that. Now, that we can manage somewhat. You know, obviously, an active trapping program during the wintertime can help reduce those numbers. Unfortunately, fur prices are such that there's not a lot of interest in people trapping those species.
Yep.
But we have some habitat management we can do as well. And we can address some of that here. Part of our study involved radio collaring raccoons. We had a young man from the University of Arkansas that came up and did some work. Jake McLean was his name, a grad student, and he put some GPS collars on raccoons on a food plotted area, a couple food plotted areas, and then a couple grasslands, looking at two things. The density of raccoons on these areas, was it different? Is that why these food plot areas seem to be struggling? And also the hunting pattern, the search pattern. Where do these raccoons go on these different landscapes? Well, no shocker here. The open grasslands had a lot lower raccoon population, lower density than our food plot areas that have a lot of mature woods, have a lot of mature tree rows. We think of quail and fence rows. Oh, we need fence rows for quail. Well, the fence row's okay if it's scrubby, but a fence row that has 30-inch DBH trees in it, those are coon dens and hawk perches. Those quail don't live in trees. That same tree row that was effective back when you were hunting with Grandpa back in the 1970s was because it was short and scrubby. People were cutting hedge posts out of it. Our tree rows have grown up, gotten over mature. We need to cut those things down and get them back to below 15 feet, get them to a scrubby height. But anyway, I digress. So these, what we found is on these strip crop, these food plotted areas, we have a lot more woody cover, mature woody cover. We have a lot higher raccoon population. No shocker there. So another thing stacked against the traditional managed area for quail versus these open grasslands. But take it a step further, we found out their travel patterns. On the grasslands, raccoons were only willing to go about 50 meters away from mature trees. They did not want to go out in the open, and I know, well, I'm a trapper. Anybody that's trapped coyotes will tell you, if you're trapping out in the wide open and you catch a coon, it's always a big boar coon. Young coons and sow coons won't go out in wide open pastures because coyotes will kill them. So they stay near what is their escape cover, a mature tree for them to climb to get away from a coyote. Well, it turns out on these traditional managed sites, these food plot areas that have more scattered trees around, we actually found these raccoons going up to 100 meters out into the open spaces. And if you look at a map, it's hard to understand here over the radio, but if you look at a map of these areas, on the grasslands, the mature woody cover is typically a draw or it's a linear. So if they go away from that, they can only escape one direction, and that's straight back where they came from to climb a tree. But on these food plot areas, there's scattered trees kind of everywhere, and then, of course, there's tree rows, and then there's mature timber. So they were venturing further away, knowing, probably, that they could escape a coyote in any direction. They could take off and out, try to get to a tree to climb a tree. So when we overlaid our nesting quail nest data on top of these raccoon travel patterns, it turns out that 75% of our nests on these grassland sites are outside the distance a raccoon is willing to travel away from a draw. So 75% of our nests are not even available to be predated by a raccoon on a grassland.
That's awesome.
On a food plot site, it turns out 50% of our nests are within travel corridors of raccoons. So we've already doubled the amount of nests available to raccoon predation on a food plot area because of scattered trees. There's a fix for that. cut down scattered trees, cut down connecting corridors. You know, if we have one little tree row that connects two tracts of timber, we've just created a travel corridor for raccoons and possums to escape coyote predation. Now, again, it depends on what your goal is, but if my goal is managing quail, and that 100% that's what I want, why do I have this connecting tree row tying two pieces of timber together? I can cut that down and replace it with wild plum or something else that raccoons will not be able to utilize, but quail still could utilize.
Mm. What about coyote predation on the quail?
Some. It's not real significant. Most research, we don't have anything specific in ours. We did have, I'm sure we get some nest predation and a little bit of adult predation. In this raccoon study, he did some overall predator re-sighting with cameras, and the raccoons were tagged. Bobcats and coyotes weren't tagged. I can tell you the traditional managed areas had a lot, surprisingly, higher coyote population as well, as opposed to these grasslands.
Weird.
They do prey some on adults. They're hard to catch. Quail are hard to catch. The adult predation suffers more from sharp shin hawks and Cooper's hawks. They're way more effective. All the research from down at Tall Timbers in the southeast says the same thing. The highest predation on adult quail is these quick flying hawks, more than mammals.
So pretty much, if I'm getting this correct, snakes and nest predators are obviously the biggest ones on your nests, with the word nest predator. But then when it comes to the adults, one of your biggest predators is the raptors.
Yep, that's exactly correct.
Okay. And basically how to combat that if you are straight quail management is trying to remove larger, more mature trees and going more in a shrubby landscape, because that not only is eliminating more nest predators like the raccoon and possums, but also probably lowering your numbers of raptors. Is that correct?
Correct. So if you look across a landscape, and we fall victim to this, you have to be diligent. You look across an open grassland landscape that has scattered thickets, and man, it looks great. But amongst those thickets, there'll be one tree that sprouts up, and eventually it's a 25-foot tree coming out of the middle of this plum thicket.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that 25-foot tree, the quail don't need it to be there, and it's providing a raptor perch.
Yeah.
That needs to go away. Cut down the tree, just cut it and stump treat it, and don't have to do anything else with it. It'll burn up eventually as we rotate around with burns. But a lot of research from the southeast shows the same, that those scattered trees are just hawk perches. Quail do not need mature trees. This is not, there's no purpose for them to be out there on the landscape if that's we're managing 100% for quail.
So with that being said, and I know this all research is grasslands, but if you're managing timber and you're like, man, I'd like to bring back more quail, obviously with that last statement, cutting, logging is a major step in moving in the right direction, correct?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not saying that you can't have quail and have trees. So I'm just saying, again, if we're going to maximize, you know, these open landscapes, of course, Texas goes through boom and bust, but the Flint Hills or central Oklahoma or central Texas on a boom year, I mean, that's just wide open, scrubby landscape, no timber anywhere in sight. That's going to be the best quail numbers possible. But savanna or open woodland type landscapes also does produce quail. And we do that on some of our public lands. It will grow quail. Yeah, there's scattered trees everywhere. They're not going to have as high nest success as they are in a wide open grassland, but it does grow some quail. So as opposed to a closed canopy forest, an open woodland or a savanna with some understory of native grasses and forbs, absolutely, that's far superior for quail production and deer or anything else. There's a lot more food in there, a lot more selection, better for turkeys than a closed canopy forest.
Mm. Yeah,
I knew this was going to happen. That there's going to, I'm going to be thinking more than preparing for the next question. But that, using that information and then combining that with your statement about grazing, it makes me go, okay, grazing savannas and woodlands would also probably be hugely important to keep the nest predation down, increase the amount of insects. And so ultimately, if you're somebody who's not in grass and landscape, you're in kind of that mix, like my family farms, and it basically comes up as upland woodland when you look at it on web soil survey. So it's like, we need to open this timber up, and we need to graze, and we need to burn, and try to get as many
Absolutely.
Native grasses and forbs back as possible.
Absolutely. And the grazing would take some tweaking. Obviously, the stocking rate is going to be quite different because
yeah.
the production is going to be a lot lower as far as tonnage of native grasses and forbs. But so a person would have to mess around with the stocking rate and the duration, but absolutely there's an opportunity to utilize both fire and grazing even in those landscapes.
Here's a question for you. When we're talking grazing on the public ground, who's cattle?
So we put that out for bid. So they're private landowners. People bid on it, and actually it's highly desirable because most of the folks don't have any native grass anymore to graze. So they know that during the summertime, all they have is fescue. Most people, suffer with endophyte-infected fescue plus drought and all that. So midsummer fescue grazing isn't that productive. So we actually get a pretty good competition on our grazing bids. People want to utilize that grass in the middle of summer because they know they'll get good yields on their cattle.
So my question for you, so when they place a bid, then they're writing a check. They're paying the Missouri Department of Conservation for those grazing rights, correct?
Correct. So that management, as opposed to food plot management, which is very expensive, uses a lot of fuel, isn't as productive for quail management. We got to buy seed, fertilizer. We spend a bunch of money doing that. And now I don't want people to think this is why I'm advocating this. It has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
It's just a nice side benefit that the grassland management actually pays for itself versus the food plot management, which is quite expensive.
Yeah, and not to get political, I won't get political. We only have a few minutes left, but the reason I asked that question is because in 2019, there's this huge division between expanding public ground and private land ownership, and with all the public ground we have, there's a lot of areas that aren't managed or they don't have the money to manage those public areas, and
yep.
there's certain things that aren't being done, but you look at grazing as a way to bring in money to then help offset some of the costs to maintain and manage that in the years to come. My gosh, you guys you're making money on this system, but also expanding quail numbers and improving habitat. I mean, what's not to love about this system?
Absolutely. Yep, there's an opportunity for both. I think in any system, of course, there needs to be the oversight. We need to make sure that the stocking rates are correct, and we got to be willing to say, hey, that didn't work out last year like I thought. We need to lower the stocking rate or increase, and I've done all those things, and I've tried all those things, and we've settled on. And what's right here will be a little different in Arizona or New Mexico or Wyoming stocking rates, but it's all possible. People just have to take the time to figure out what makes sense for the species or the natural community that they're trying to manage. It may
yeah.
not be for a certain species of bird or animal. It may be just to maintain the quality of the native prairie.
With that, with those grasslands, are you seeing any bobolinks migrating through?
Oh yeah, we do have bobolinks come through, and we see them on these grasslands. Yep, they don't nest down here. I am personally not aware of any nesting bobolinks on any of my areas, but they do up in northwest Missouri on some of our prairie areas.
That's amazing. I, being a nerd to the natural communities, I've never even seen a bobolink because of the, I guess, lack of grasslands around me. So that's kind of
yeah.
one of my bucket lists is to see. What other species? I know there's a couple key species that are also benefiting from this that are, I believe, are species of concern, if not rated a little worse than that.
that utilizes similar habitat?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Yeah, so on these grasslands, we get quite a bit of use of Henslow sparrows. They're a species of conservation concern. Grasshopper sparrows. Henslow sparrows like a little denser vegetation, so they'll be in the unburned unit, even though it's being grazed. You know, they'll be in the two-year-ago burn unit. Mm-hmm. Grasshopper sparrows, here's a good example. Fire alone management for grasshopper sparrows versus grazing and fire. We have a 12-fold increase for grasshopper sparrows where we do grazing and fire as opposed to fire alone.
Wow.
They are a species of conservation concern. They like short stuff, so they're in the this year's burn heaviest grazed part. So Bell's vireos, they live in the thickets out on these grasslands, spend their time up in the tops of the thickets. So, yeah, there's several species. We even have crawfish frogs out on some of these native prairies, native grasslands, prairie mole crickets, some species that certainly needs help that respond well. You know, grazing was just as much of a natural disturbance to our grasslands. You know, all this stuff here from Bolivar and where you're sitting, West Kansas, was mostly prairie 300 years ago.
Yeah.
And most of these species, they all evolved with fire and grazing. Those were both disturbances on the grassland landscape. So we're not introducing anything that wasn't historically part of this landscape. And in fact, there's species like the grasshopper sparrow that needs the grazing, or it doesn't function. The entire ecosystem, the grassland ecosystem, isn't functioning properly without fire and grazing. If we were just to graze and remove fire, we are removing one of those mechanisms by which this community evolved. I think it's necessary to have all those historical disturbances to maintain the integrity of these community types.
I agree 100%. You made me think of the Henry Schoolcraft book whenever he went up to the town of Springfield and went just west, and
yep.
He talked about standing up in the stirrups and still not being able to see over the grass.
Yep, and then he also commented on the occasional droves of buffaloes that would travel through. So
that's right.
Drove, we knew there was big groups of buffalo moving through, so
yep.
They did exist here, and they did make an impact on the landscape.
The part about that book that got me, since you've read the book too, is when he talks about going up the White River, hitting the mouth of Beaver Creek, and then going up Beaver Creek a couple of miles and running into a huge column that went up a couple hundred feet in the air. And then I think that was right around Christmas. And this was 1818, so 200 years ago. And basically, they killed a buffalo, and they said that they didn't have the equipment or the boats and horses to pull it back, so they stashed it in the woods and covered it in leaves to keep the wolves from finding it. That just blows my mind. It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, pretty crazy to think what was on the landscape not that long ago.
Not that long ago, and it sounds like you guys are, all you're really doing is replicating that.
That's right, and the species that react to it, they do their thing. So.
Oh, man. I can't thank you enough. Is there any other, like, cool things that we haven't talked about that was just, like, a side note that was like, oh, this, we found this to be really cool during the study?
You know, something really big that we're going to try to push out to people, landowners and the public, everybody, MDC employees, was the nest timing. We knew that we had some late hatches some years, right? We've all killed some young quail. Early, say, you know, first day of season, and you kill some quail that are only 3/4 grown.
Yeah.
We found out that everyone used to think the peak hatch of quail was June 15th in Missouri. And after that, there's a little bit of renesting, and there's, you know, but it's kind of piddly. And in fact, on public lands where we're still doing haying, we used to defer that to July 15th. Well, get past nesting season. Well, it turns out that over 50% of our nests don't even begin incubation, which takes 23 days to incubate, by the way. Over 50% of our nests, if you combined all 5 years of research, don't even start incubation until after July 1.
Holy cow.
So there is never a good time to recreational mow. in the summer, you are potentially running over quail nests. There is never a good time to hay. You are potentially, if you're trying to maximize quail, those two practices cannot occur from May through the end of September. We even had a nest hatch the first week of October. Now, that was one out of 500 nests, but we are having birds hatch all summer. And in fact, we have a peak. We do have a peak in June, but we have a peak in July, a peak in August. I mean, it's continuous.
How many?
And our peak in August is as high as our peak in June.
So. Unbelievable. How many? So how many times do they re-nest? Is that multiple nests every summer?
Some birds. So the most we had was three nesting attempts by a hen.
Yep.
And by the way, about 20% of the nests get incubated by males, but that's pretty common. So she'll lay a nest, and then she'll tell her boyfriend to go sit on it, and then she might go have another nest, which is great. We can get double nesting that way. And we did document some of that as well. But typically, the ones that tried two and three times, the triple nest was because the first two were lost. It wasn't because they were successful. We only had, out of 500 nesting attempts, and you know, so a little under 200 of those were successful. I can only think of two times that we actually had a bird pull off a nest, raise her brood, cut them loose, and then go have another nest.
Wow.
Double brooding is quite rare.
Yeah, okay.
It was typically re-nest. If they were successful the first nest, they stayed with them all summer.
Okay.
Or if they failed, something predated, they would try again and try again. But even at that, the triple attempt was less than 5%. We had very few birds that had enough energy to keep nesting.
Yeah.
Re-nesting, the double, you're trying again because your first nest was lost, I believe was somewhere in the 20-25% range. But that shows you that there's a large percentage of them, if that one nest fails, they're done for the year. They just don't, I guess they don't have the energy to do it again.
I'd always heard, I think this is true, but like over the course of the year, only 30% of the actual quail population to that location survives, and it's up to them to repopulate the next year.
That's correct. Actually, it's a little worse. On an average year, it's about 20%, 80% mortality. So,
wow.
If you've got a covey of 20 birds, there's probably only going to be about four or five of them make it through the whole season, and those are the ones that have got to make a new covey. So, everything likes to eat them. We like to eat them. They taste good.
Yeah.
A very high death rate. And, of course, most of that's when they're young, but they suffer predation year-round from all different species of stuff. And it's a tough go for the poor little guys. But
yeah, no pressure at all for the 20% that make it.
Yeah, right.
Everybody depends on you. Oh, man.
Yes.
What about, now, I've had a major brain fart, but I'm trying to remember what the term is to where we saw this some in Iowa. We would jump a hen pheasant. We'd go up to it to count our eggs, and there'd be a couple quail eggs thrown in there. Did you guys see much of that?
Nest parasitism. No, we don't get other species dumping eggs in quail nests. They're really well hidden.
Yeah.
They tuck them. They'll make a tunnel into a base of warm season grass or a clump of grass, and we don't have that. What we did have, we found interesting. And it could have been rodents, could have been snakes. We've talked to some other researchers, and they've documented with nest cameras both, is the removal, the slow removal of eggs.
Huh.
So we may have a nest of, say, 15 eggs. And we would only check on the nest if the hen was off of it or the rooster, whoever was incubating, right? And we'd move in to see if the nest had been predated or what had happened. And we had techs, this would happen on about 20% of our nests, where they would move in and there's a couple eggs missing. And then the next time they move in, there's two or three more eggs missing. So what happens, either it's a small snake that can't eat all of the eggs, so it just takes a couple. And then, you know, a few days later, it's hungry, comes back, takes a couple more. Or some type of rodent that would, you know, a pack rat or something, and grabs a couple eggs and off he goes with them. Both of those have been documented across other research sites. So kind of interesting. Sometimes they'd still hatch. They might hatch 10 eggs, but they started out with 15, and they lost 5 over the course of incubation. So kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Fascinating research, man. I can't. We could go on and on. I'm sure as soon as we hang up, I'm gonna be like, oh, I forgot to ask about that. But so much to chew on and think about over this podcast. I sure hope everybody enjoyed it. It's been long, long overdue. It only took 100 podcasts for us to finally do one devoted to the quail. But hopefully everybody enjoyed it. And is this research published anywhere?
Not yet. So this just wrapped up. The research just got completed this last field season. So we're going to start working on that. We hope to do a couple things. One, full-blown journal, you know, published research article.
Yeah.
We're hoping that that'll come out within about a year from now. But we hope to have something more practical. I mean, a lot of people aren't going to have access to the Journal of Wildlife Management, right, or whatever journal we end up getting published. So we're hoping to put together some one-page kind of fact sheets that we can hand out to landowners, to, you know, at Quail Forever events, you name it. Stuff, for example, there might be a one-pager just about nest timing and what our data shows. And, again, radio colors don't lie. Hey, here's how quail in Missouri are actually nesting, and this is when they're doing it, and this is the sites they're choosing. So if you're going to do management with a brush hog, you need to do it during these months. Or management with your four-wheeler spraying Sarisa, and you're going to drive every inch of your property, you need to spray your burn units first because there's no nests in there, and then switch to these units. You know, I mean, we have that data.
Mm.
And so we could put together fact sheets about that kind of stuff, about the raccoon study and cutting down isolated trees or connecting woody corridors. We're hoping we put together basically several little fact sheets on implications of management that was derived from this research.
Yeah, I think it'd be highly used. I think people would use this research a lot. To me, you're already blowing my mind when you said the basically grazing compared to fire. It's kind of something that, like you said earlier in the podcast, grazing is looked at as a bad thing when you drive across the landscape, but if used correctly, it's highly important to a lot of species. So, man, well, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your knowledge and research, and I'm sure we're going to have emails come in on this one, and we're going to have you back on sometime in the future.
Be glad to do it anytime. I'm excited. We didn't want this research to go to waste. We didn't want it just to be used for our own biologists. We want to get this information out there, and we've passed it along, in fact, to several other states. So
awesome.
This is good information. I appreciate having the chance to share it.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Kyle. We'll catch you guys next time.
All right. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. I enjoyed it, and I know they did too. And I know one thing out of all this, Kyle's coming back on the podcast very, very soon, because we didn't even touch on just overall quail management and breaking down northern bobwhite quail diet, other ways to manage for them.
Brood rearing, all
the
necessities.
We didn't even talk about it. Right. It's all about really the research that's been done under his kind of leadership or that he's been part of over the last 7 years. So anyway, I hope we get some emails about this one.
So that one hopefully stirred up some interest.
Yeah.
And we've talked about it on another podcast before too, though. It seems as if quail hunters tend to be the people who are managing the most intensely because of the need.
When you think of the main kind of game species, like there's some probably grouse guys out there that are doing all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
But when you look at turkey, quail, deer,
duck.
Elk, duck people are pretty big into it. But as far as quail go, it's so crucial that you manage so intensively that those guys are really the ones that are kind of,
they need that,
they're doing so much,
gotta do it.
And so you heard it right there, he chose cattle grazing over the fire as far as broad, much bigger broad management. If you had to I think he said
you put him in a box, right?
Tie his hands behind his back and push him in a corner. He's probably going to pick that one just because Incredible. He can manage more acres with it. And that's one thing. We did a podcast way back, probably last fall, mm-hmm. with Dan Johnson, and he asked us to describe our perfect situation or our perfect farm. And I'm like, I'm probably going to have cows on it.
Sure.
I'm sure he was like, what are you smoking down there?
he goes, that's just the southern Missouri coming out.
Yeah, and to me, that right there was a great example of that because of the fact that not only does it make your landscape more productive, but it's a great way to make income for yourself. And now research is showing that it's even more important to species like the northern bobwhite quail than we may have originally thought. So
I love solid information that breaks down walls and barriers and perceptions of practices that are like, you know what, actually, if it's done appropriately and done right, it's incredibly beneficial. We just got to get there.
That's right.
In our understanding and education. So share this. Share this with people that you want to see change the way that they manage their properties. Hope you guys enjoyed it. See you later.